name's Nick Sawyer, and welcome to the Swap Podcast, where we exchange news and views on the latest trends in derivatives and finance. The cost of transitioning to a green economy is estimated to be northward of $100 trillion between now and 2050, and some estimates go way higher than that. That sort of money is highly unlikely to come from governments alone, so financial markets will play a critical role in enabling capital to flow from where it's currently held, in the hands of investors around the world, to where it's needed, the green technologies and infrastructure projects vital to achieving net zero goals. For example, the voluntary carbon market enables those companies unable to immediately transition fully from fossil fuels to buy credits to offset their emissions, which channels capital to those projects that generate credits by reducing or removing greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. That's just one example, though. A wide variety of financing, investment, and hedging solutions have emerged to help companies and investors meet their environmental, social, and governance objectives. In this episode, we'll look at how one institution has elevated sustainability to be a core part of its business, mirroring the sustainable development strategy of its home country, Singapore. Is the CEO, Scott O'Malley, is here with me. So Scott, why don't you tell us who you'll be speaking with?
Sure, I'll be speaking with Michael Sin, President and Head of Global Markets Division at the Singapore Exchange, or SGX. As you mentioned, SGX has put a big focus on sustainable and green finance, so I'm keen to talk to Michael about how he sees that evolving and how important is sustainable finance in Singapore and the broader Asia-Pacific region and what does success look like for SGX. But I'd also like to get Michael's views on a variety of other topics, including the outlook for Asia markets, margin practice, and the use of technology. But it's also important that I wish you a very happy birthday. Nick, thank you for coming in on your birthday and cutting this podcast with us.
I can't think of any better way to celebrate. Well, with that, let's get on with it. Over to you, Scott.
All right, Michael, welcome to the Swap. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks. Great to be with you, Scott.
All right, let's start off with an outlook for the Asia-Pacific region. The IMF is projecting an economic slowdown in 2024 with GDP contractions across the region as a result of China's slowdown and lower growth in productivity. What are your expectations for the Asia market in 2024, and how will the year unfold?
Big question. Here in Singapore, we've just finished our Chinese New Year, and this is what happens in Chinese New Year. You catch up with people you haven't seen for a year, and they say, hey, you work at the exchange. You have to know something about which way markets are going. And then they ask the question that you ask, can I buy this stock as our market's going up? It's been really hard this year. The usual answer is, if I knew, I wouldn't be working at the exchange. This year, it's probably more nuanced because the very idea that there would be a singular Asian market view is really challenged, right? So if we look at 2023, there were some big market outperformers. And even more than Japan. Japan had a big year, of course. Taiwan had a bigger year than Japan, and we know why that is, because Taiwan makes all the chips that NVIDIA sells. India had a big year for its own reasons. And of course, China and Hong Kong had a really terrible year. So giving an aggregate answer for 2024 is going to be difficult. I'd say that the way we sort of think about it and the way that's going to be relevant to us, right, is there's some part of it microeconomics, which is country by country. What we see most of in Singapore in microeconomic terms is that demand's getting strangled a bit by high interest rates. A lot of the post-COVID euphoria is wearing off. Prices and services particularly are fairly high. So demand is tailing off. You're seeing this in property, you're seeing this in tourism. So that's microeconomics. Macroeconomics, more complex because dollar rates have historically been a big driver of how trade and commerce works in this part of the world. But there are internal macroeconomic forces in countries like Indonesia and India, which overpower anything that happens or comes in via the US dollar, right? There's an internal dynamism to some of these economies that means that they are likely to go regardless of what projections we have. And then the thing that matters to us isn't really microeconomics or macroeconomics. It's geoeconomics. It's what falls slightly short of geopolitics, but really hits the economic sphere. Because the sort of grammar of commerce that happens between Asian economies drives the logic of conflict. And by conflict, I mean economic contention, economic disputes, economic disagreement. And you know, that's the lifeblood of the exchange. We love people disagreeing on price. They come to the exchange, they duke it out, and they create volume, they create a price. So the long answer to your question is that geoeconomics is going to be a very important driver of market behavior in the way that matters to the global audience.
Well, let's hope they come to the exchange and express themselves in their different opinions.
Yes.
Well, you've been in your current role at SGX. Well, you've been in SGX for, I think, over 13 years. Your current role for nearly 6 months, heading up the global markets division with responsibilities for equities, fixed income, currencies, and commodities. What are your specific priorities for those asset classes?
So the priorities I have are in many ways about looking forward, particularly post this COVID period. We had an okay but trying COVID period. We had a sort of getting back to normal period. And then a lot of the focus of my role is, what does it mean to future-proof the exchange? And there's a couple of dimensions to that. How do I future-proof the exchange from a sort of people perspective? Because we're getting more international. We're having to operate onshore in areas that previously we hadn't done. For instance, we've got staff in India now, which is unusual for an exchange to have operating presences outside its home market. I have to future-proof the organization, the way we organize ourselves. That's reflected in the way we think about asset classes. I have to sort of future-proof the platform, the business platform. And all of this comes down to a sort of view we have to form about the future of the market network, or rather market structure as pertains to Singapore Exchange. So market structure views, again, I tie it back to geoeconomics, right? In the next 5-10 years, it matters a great deal how much balkanization or deglobalization happen. You might question, why does this matter to the exchange? Well, one very simple example would be, today we're primarily a US dollar exchange. Most of our margin collateral movement is in US dollars. What happens if the market structure that we represent starts fragmenting to a part of the market that says, I want to use RMB, I want to use Chinese government bonds as collateral? Then we have to think about how we continue to operate as a future-proofed exchange in that context. And that's really what I meant by this overall term of geoeconomics. There are some things which are not subject to these forces. And these are sort of outside my mandate. But I have to say, we do spend some time thinking about it. Because these are areas where it's very clear the US is leading, and the rest of the world hasn't even started thinking about economics in this sense. So what is the economics of space? What are the economics of the digital first environment, the metaverse, if you like? What are the economics of the ocean even? For small countries like Singapore or regions in Asia which are fragmented, we don't have a theory of success that says that as an exchange, I need to be increasingly relevant in my structure to the space economy, the digital economy, to, you know, the ocean economy. It's really just the modern economy as we understand it. I think that many of the things that we're doing meet the needs of market participants when it comes to accessing Asian capital markets. I would say that there has been a greater desire to do business through Singapore and through the Singapore Exchange. If you're an investor into India, as an example, we recently launched a thing called the Gift Connect into India, first of its kind. And that clearly launched at a good period because India's run up massive capital inflows. We have always had a Japan complex of total return futures, repo futures, dividend futures. And with all this interest in not just investing in Japan, but also the normalization of the yield curve, a lot of interest has come back into dividend term structures, into repo term structures. So all that stuff is stuff that we will continue to do, which is offer access, multi-asset into Asia. But a lot of the role that I have is to try and think about how we organize ourselves to be future-proofed for the market network.
Fantastic. You've kind of touched on the interest rate impacts, but we've also seen a series of unexpected market shocks in recent years, triggered by the pandemic, of course, in 2020, Russia's invasion of Ukraine in 2022, and several bank failures in 2023, obviously with dollar-denominated trade. That might have affected you as well. We've also seen a significant rise in interest rates across the globe. In each case, financial markets were affected, and market participants had to manage periods of stress, volatility, and of course, higher funding costs. How has this played through on your platform? And you kind of talked about some of the future vision you have, but how are these all of these played through these shocks, and how do you plan for that?
That's a really totemic question, because as an exchange, clearly we have a very specific regulated role where, just like banks transform short to long, we transform, if you like, counterparty credit risk into market liquidity risk, right? That's why we're regulated as tightly as we are, because we undertake a financial transformation activity. So if I start with that, there's two parts to your question. One part is operationally, in performing this transformation activity, how do we do this in a way which is resilient to possibly unknown scenarios, right? Routinely risky and not routinely risky. And you've pointed out some extremely interesting outliers: COVID, unprecedented, almost impossible to game for, the movement of gas and oil prices over the invasion of Ukraine, and the bank failures. In all of these, I'd say that we felt proud of our ability and our peer group's ability to keep ticking along. Like, exchanges did what they did, which is allow the dislocation in events caused over COVID, caused over the invasion, caused over the bank failure. We allowed these dislocations to be integrated into market prices in a way which did not break the market, right? The market continued to function. It absorbed the information innovation. This led to price innovation. And the market, as you know, is the most magnificent mechanism known to man for orchestrating global economic activity. It kind of reduces all these facts into a thing, a number. Number go up, number go down. And that number tells you to produce less, consume less, or produce more, consume more. So that invisible hand that we saw up front allowed us to deal with procurement challenges. Because what was possibly different about some of these disruptions, particularly COVID, particularly the Russian invasion, is that it led to interruptions in the transport of physical things, of molecules. And the market mechanism was a very powerful tool to help figure out how much more shipping could you bring to bear. How would you reroute electron from point A to point B? How would you ship more mask or grow more cotton to do these things? Now, these are very complicated global economic orchestration activities. And what we know about the invisible hand is that it's the best tool we have, the best tool we know, to manage supply and demand across the global economy. So the answer to that question is that I think that most commodity markets and capital markets functioned really well in doing their part in smoothing these procurement crises over the periods of shocks.
Global policymakers have been exploring the margin practices in cleared and non-cleared markets following the periods of stress, as you mentioned, and they've recently published various recommendations on the transparency and responsiveness of margin, right? So this is cleared margin, this is non-cleared margin. We saw some extreme volatility. Probably the most extreme was around the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the interruption of gas, and where does it come from? How do we get it? So producers and people who were in the market at that time saw extreme margin pressure. So how does SGX approach transparency of margin calculations? How do you think about ensuring that the robustness of the exchanges of margin practices in volatile times? There's a heightened transformation of margin. There's a high number of exchanges that have to go on. We know that in the COVID period that it really stressed several exchanges in terms of back office and managing the exchange. How does this all play through to SGX and your positioning using technology, et cetera?
Okay, big question. So a series of things working backwards from the reality of where we are, you know, an exchange in Singapore, small country in Asia. So first observation that we've had since we really started operating, particularly in futures since Cymex, is flight to quality is a thing that happens in crises. So do everything necessary that when margins start becoming acute, like the computation, the changes, and the insufficiency or sufficiency of margins start being an acute factor, make sure that you are a flight to quality destination. Because if you're not, there's nothing you can do in advance that's going to stop that cascade. Right. So principle number one is make sure that you are a flight to quality destination. In doing that, we make sure we have several features that are relevant to our market. Number one, we try to make sure that we have an extraordinary amount of skin in the game in the clearing fund, which gives confidence to clearing members. Not only is it basically the largest of any clearinghouse, it's also scalable. More risk comes, we put more money in. Secondly, we margin frequently. We do our very, very best to share publicly and with our risk advisory committee, which is buy side and sell side, how do we set margins? How do we do stress tests? So there is a high degree of trust that these things aren't made up idiosyncratically. Now, everything that we think we can do well and in industry-wide transparent way, I feel that we do. We participate, we lead CCP 12 from time to time. We participate in forums, we consult. But I also want to make a distinction about, I suppose you could call it good regulation, right? And by regulation, I mean it in its largest sense. Regulation in the sense of maintaining balance, homeostasis. So actually there is, believe it or not, there is a theorem called the good regulator theorem. And this theorem appears in the literature about robots, cybernetics. Because what it says is, if you wanted to have a mega robot that runs the world of clearing or risk, what would it take for this good regulator to be an optimal regulator? And the answer to this extremely complex theorem, you can go Google it, many, many pages, is the very best and optimal regulator must be a model of the system it seeks to regulate, right? It has to be a sort of digital twin of the thing it's seeking to regulate. And then it can do things like speed your heart up, slow your heart down, raise your temperature, lower your body temperature. The brain, as an example, is a good regulator. It regulates our body temperature for homeostasis. So as an exchange or a CCP for our immediate ecosystem, we try and operate as a good regulator. And the one thing a good regulator thinks a great deal about is not just risk measurement, but risk management, some of which is forward-looking, some of which is about playing the feedback system. So the point about margins is important, but I suppose I'm saying all of this to make sure that we understand that the setting and the transparency and the mechanism of setting margins is a sort of single issue risk measurement matter. It's important, but it's not the dominating thing. The really dominating thing is multi-factor risk management. So setting margins well in and of itself doesn't matter when you're risk is transported through the system by FCMs, which are much bigger than you and connected to multiple exchanges and have all sorts of hidden unknown sources of risk in them. So that's my answer, and it's not a defensive one.
How about the operational challenges? Is the collateral system today fit for purpose?
It is, for us in particular, it's tough because, as I mentioned earlier, we operate in US dollars. We operate in RMB, operate in yen, operate in Aussie dollars. But because we're not in any of those countries, I don't have direct access to the central bank window. So we deal in commercial bank money, and commercial bank money comes with certain risks. And therefore, we also have to be fluent in managing securities. And that gives our members a great deal of comfort. So managing US treasuries, JGBs, all of these lead to, in some sense, the greater security in terms of ownership of certain assets, and it gives them more collateral flexibility. But when it comes to managing swiftly, managing liquidity, they also bring risks to the system, because liquidating US treasuries in Asian time can actually bring risks to the system. So one of the things we do a lot of is consult our members, but also have a direct market view that says, if we're multi-currency, multimodal, multi-collateral, it probably in aggregate lowers single-factor risk, but each one of these comes with its own risk contribution. It's a necessary way to do business, I think, for the future in the context of what I mentioned earlier. The market's getting more deglobalized, getting more balkanized, certain sorts of members. And we do have various different species of members. Apart from the global FCMs, we've got lots of Chinese brokers, we have Indian brokers, we have local ASEAN brokers. They all have different liquidity bases and collateral bases. So we do our very best to make sure that everyone understands where everyone else is coming from, and in aggregate that we've managed out as much of the operating risk in the exchange through reducing any single risk factor to a relatively smaller one. In terms of actual operating, I spoke about operational risk there. In terms of actual operating risk, I guess we do a lot of drills. We do a lot of rollbacks, roll forwards. We try to communicate. We try not to surprise. It is inevitable that when you deal with a connected series of systems, that things go down. A particular vendor might have a cyber attack. A particular data center can go down. I think it is a test of resilience that up till now we have managed to continue ticking. And this is true of the global industry.
Now, SGX has put sustainability at the core of its business, aiming to become a top financing and trading hub in the area, as has the government of Singapore as well. So how is the exchange approaching this, and to what extent does sustainability affect all of these business lines?
Surprisingly for me, actually, I mean, I was born here, and it never occurred to me that your average Singaporean or even politician would think that much about it. You know what I mean? You come here, and Singapore is an example. Literally, it's the world's best example of an unsustainable thing. It's an island built at a place where you ought not to have an island city. Everything about it is, in some sense, not sustainable. It is order wrought out of something which naturally ought not to have a city in it. It's reliant on oil. It's reliant on peace with neighbors. It's reliant on shipping to bring it in. So the sustainability of this proposition, which is Singapore, is instinctively, I always thought that the population and the government would say, yeah, that's for the other people, right? People with large prairie lands and hydroelectric dams. So it's really surprised me that the country and even the people by and large have taken on to sustainability, particularly in the climate sense, in the environmental sense, very, very seriously. I suppose it's a function of being a developed market, if you like, a more modern society where people travel and they more genuinely understand. Also, it's a function of being at the front line of what hot feels like. You come here pretty often. It was already hot. Now imagine it getting 3-4 degrees hotter. Imagine the sea level rising. It is a very real thing. So as Singapore's sort of national market infrastructure, SGX, we've taken to this wholeheartedly. There's a number of things we try to do, because clearly making Singapore and the exchange sustainable isn't really contributing much to a global problem. It's a collective action problem. We have to do as much as we can through the facilities that we have to bring along the regional market ecosystem, the global market ecosystem. It's one of the first things that we as SGX have ever done, which is global in nature. Almost everything else we do, sort of like pan-Asian or regional, right? So we've done a handful of things because we felt we had to do this differently. First of all, unusually for an exchange, we've tried to go straight to the top of the house on some of these global committees which form consensus around rules and things like that. So one of our colleagues is the vice chair of TCFD. We are a principal founder of the GFANS Alliance, which is for financial service providers. We co-chair one of the GFANS work groups, which talks about how to move 80 trillion of passive capital into being climate aware. I'll come back to this. This is really important. We host, in fact, in our building, the Asia Pacific Network for GFANS. So why are we doing this? Number one, we do want to know what's happening at the top table, because while these rules are being rolled out, from time to time, they're fairly Eurocentric. They're not necessarily totally relevant to emerging markets in the region or even developed markets in the region. Say Japan, they have to import all their molecules to make electrons. It's a lot of the things which prescriptions which people say, you know, have nuclear. Well, can't nuclear zone. So, you know, earthquake zone. Have wind power. Yeah, maybe. You know, have wave power. Yeah, maybe. That doesn't work for Laos, as an example. So we have to make it relevant by sitting at the top table as to what these rules are. Secondly, we're a stock exchange and a regulator. So we also want to make sure that we're able to roll this out in a way that brings along $1 trillion worth of market cap, which is what's listed on SGX. Thirdly, and this is, I guess, our commitment to thought leadership and giving back, it's capacity building, which is a fancy name for saying we have to educate, share resources, help draw out guidelines, help form consensus, help roll things out. And finally, and very importantly, which is our core business, is are there products and services that exchanges offer which help in this journey for transition finance? And this is where I'll come to net zero benchmarks. A lot of the work that's been done by central banks in particular has been about catalytic capital, like bringing new money to the table that helps finance infrastructure that makes the economy, makes the environment more sustainable. Our biggest effort is something called climate action. We do this together with MSCI. And the ambition is pretty bold. It's to literally create a new category in capital markets. Today, almost all of the capital that's allocated is, let's say, 70, 80 trillion indexed to MSCI Universal, MSCI World. Two-thirds of that and more are passive. They follow an index. So they'll follow an index called World. They'll follow an index called Emerging Markets, Developed Markets, Asia-Pacific. And that index is very important because it represents permanent capital. This isn't temporary capital like a bank loan or even a 10-year bond. This is permanent capital. The climate crisis, another way of saying this climate crisis, it's the biggest market failure in human history, right? The climate crisis is a result of the biggest market failure in human history. Because in our global economy, since the first and second industrial revolution, we did not price in the negative external effects of greenhouse gas emission. It was never priced into any sort of economic activity. And because it was priced at zero, it ended up being really easy and really cheap to degrade the earth and pollute the earth and, you know, and consume fossil fuels. So our starting point is, the climate crisis was caused by an immense market failure. And the cure for this market failure is to price appropriately green activities at a premium and brown activities at a discount. And we know that we have to do this in a way which is 100% compatible with the way asset owners allocate capital, meaning through global indices, meaning through permanent capital. So in short, what we do is we make sure that the new category of indices track very, very closely in performance to the non-climate indices, because a lot of the difference in performance is usually through sector weights. So what happens is that within each sector, we keep their weight in the economy stable. But we promote the best and most green companies with a higher weight, and we demote the brown companies with a lower weight. The reason this is important is that it makes use of the disclosures and the forward-looking plans of the decarbonizing companies, and we give them a premium valuation. We give them a higher capital weighting, and we make this a very public signal in the market. We also make sure that this is 100% explainable to the companies and their shareholders. So if a company is starting to lag in its price performance or its valuation versus its peer group, it is 100% explainable that it's because they're doing a worse job in decarbonizing than the best in that peer group. And the final and most important thing about this methodology is it's 100% inclusive. Like, even if you're private equity today and you're not in the index, we can show you where you would rank in the index, and you can benchmark yourself. So this is something, this is a new category that we're doing. We're calling it climate action. It is the biggest pool of permanent capital there is in the world. And in our co-chairmanship of the committee at GFANZ, we're trying to move the asset owners to direct more assets into there. And that movement's beginning.
It is that we've been heavily focused on the development of voluntary carbon markets, kind of to your point about pricing these externalities. We believe this has a real opportunity to play a role in the transition to net zero. Singapore has been working to position itself as an Asia hub for carbon trading. What will success look like in this area?
So it's an incredibly important initiative, and ISDA is doing wonderful work in the enabling superstructure, if you like, to get these credits tradable. Because if they're purely a bilateral market, they would not perhaps have as much of an external public good than if there was a marketplace to form a benchmark. We are working very hard through this Climate Impact X initiative with Standard Chartered, with DBS Temasek. We have to get a few things going. One initiative is to bring companies along to sort of educate them as to how you properly procure credits. The second initiative would be, how do you bring projects to market such that they have some confidence that they can get funding in order to generate these credits? And thirdly, of course, to try and form some kind of price benchmark so people can make economy-wide decisions as to the price of pollution versus the price of offsetting. These efforts are happening slower than I originally thought, because actually dealing with voluntary credits it's necessary, but it's slightly hairy. And we've seen from time to time questions cast over the integrity, for example, of certain projects. I would say that for us, we think that the work that's already been done will not ever be wasted. So certainly documentation as to what a tradable voluntary credit should be is going to be necessary, no matter the market structure. The one concern I suppose I have is that many of our customers who purchase credits, they don't typically look for the cheapest credit. This is normal in a commodity market. By a definition of commodity, you know, there's gold here, there's gold there. I will buy gold where it's cheapest because the molecules are fungible. Gold is gold. Same with most commodities. This is not actually that true of the customers that we have today. They want the highest grade nature-based carbon credits, right? They want things which aren't specifically to do with the carbon capture. They want co-benefits. They want to know that these projects are doing much more than just capturing carbon. So there's a part of me that says that over time, to fulfill these needs, carbon credits, which are in a sort of IOU, which have some sort of legal enforceability, which have tracking, but also have the risk of default because the tree can be chopped down or burnt down, it starts looking more like a mortgage. And maybe the next innovation will be to say, do we actually need to pool these credits together in such a way that there's a sort of first loss, second loss, high grade, medium grade securitization of carbon in a pool? So there aren't initiatives that go in this direction, but I think that all the work that ISDA is doing and we're doing is absolutely applicable if the market heads in that direction.
I completely agree. It's got to be a race to the top. Better quality credits are going to rise, the price will rise, you'll get the performance you're looking for, and you'll have the reliability on your balance sheet of having really transparent, auditable credits that perform as expected and don't bring reputational risk. So I think
absolutely
all of those things are a must for this market to survive and thrive, which it has some great potential.
Yeah.
Now, how are you applying the last bit is the conversation around AI. This has taken, we shifted from blockchain to AI pretty quickly. super fascinating. You just need to put AI in front of your name and up you go. So how are you applying this cutting edge technology at SGX?
Carefully, I hope. The enthusiasm that comes with some of these AI tools has honestly been even more than came with crypto and blockchain. And as you say, that kind of faded pretty fast. I don't really get that many bright young colleagues saying, oh, we need to move faster on this old blockchain crypto stuff. It's now something else. We have three use cases which we think have permanent and sustainable relevance to running a future-proof market, running a better market. There are lots of things to do with, I hate the word AI. I know it's used generally. It's really advanced methods of machine learning, pattern recognition. It's unsupervised learning, which makes it even more powerful. And if we think of it that way, rather than overemphasize the fact that it's got a sort of intelligence, I think we think more carefully about how to use it in a way which is governable. One of the most important things, which brings almost immediate value to us, our participants in our peer group, is if you have a system of self-learning at scale, which can operate 24 hours a day and continue to learn from its examples, that is a perfect tool for anomaly detection. And this ranges from anomalies in surveillance to anomalies in your security perimeter to the operation of your hard disks. Is this disk about to fail? And the sort of huge efforts we put in, which we call it's resilient by effort rather than resilient by design. I think some of these machine learning tools will allow us to be resilient by design. So anomaly detection, early warning, stresses in the system, cues to maybe start preparing to collect margin early, cues to tell you that perhaps this client might be slightly late because of information you've gathered elsewhere. Absolutely all of this is incremental to the value and resilience of the market network that we operate. So anomaly detection is a really big one. It does require us putting the data in the right place so that the machine can learn properly what is normal and therefore what's an anomaly. The first application we have of this is actually just through surveillance, because there's reams of well-organized data and there's lots of humans looking at it, pointing out anomalies. So the training is very, very easy for, you know, self-trading, wash trading, anomalous trading. The second category is really a business one, which is it does irritate the hell out of me when I have to talk to three people and look at four files to find out my last contact with a customer. Right, it's spread over five databases. It's spread over seven people's Outlook calendars. There's some stuff in Salesforce. But what you're supposed to be able to do is go to this machine that has access to all the information and say, who spoke to this customer last? Was the customer happy? Are there any things that he asked for that we haven't followed up on? So the second tool is actually just being better at customer service. The first applications that we have of this is actually not the institutional customer. We run a stock market, we run a direct depository with almost 2 million customers. So our first applications of this tool is just better customer service. If you're going to call the call center, I don't want to put you on hold for 10 minutes. I want to have some way to pre-anticipate your problem or even solve your problem offline. And I also want to have a series of call notes for the call agent that says, look, we think that this customer has this problem, has this profile, probably we already need to say the following things to the customer. So both for institutional customers and for retail customers, managing your CRM, that's a really powerful tool. The third one is the one that's talked a lot about that I have mixed feelings about. This is the idea of the first draft, where whether as a writer or as a coder, a lot of time that you spend is actually coming up with the first version of the document, first version of the code. What today's AI models or machine learning models are really, really good at is giving you a workable first draft. And from the data I've seen, certainly for paralegals, for junior coders, it doubles, triples productivity. Because a lot of the code that we have to write internally is really mundane stuff, which is map this file to this database for this regulatory report. And then I have to wait, you know, a month before some guy codes this thing up. But in future, I should just be able to say, here's my request. And it comes up with a sort of first draft of the code. Then I get someone to review that code and say, okay, let's go into production.
Fascinating. I'd like to wrap up our conversation with asking a little bit about you and your journey in financial services. How and why did you choose financial services as a career? Was it always your plan? And are you advising your children to follow your footsteps into financial services?
It was all a terrible mistake. I did a PhD at what was at the time one of the world's leading machine intelligence labs. And we did a bunch of stuff on computer vision, face recognition, all the stuff you'll see out there now. And at the time we concluded there's no future in this. All the cool guys are heading to the city. The city's hiring lots of people who can sort of do numbers and, you know, reasonably large and agile, because it was still pit trading in life, right? So you roughly needed people who could do some maths and people who could stand and shout and sort of move elbows around. And that's how I got started in finance. So it's been pretty accidental. I did catch up recently with my PhD group, and I have to say that when I look at the glorious careers they've had in academia and in the Valley, I do think, oh, finance, what a terrible mistake that was. Having said that, I work at the Exchange, and at the Exchange, we try to persuade ourselves that we're doing something more than just finance. We're trying to harness this machine, this incredible mechanism, the invisible hand. And this machine is the only machine known to man which can transform selfish, greedy individuals into a public good, right? So our model is that individuals are selfish, meaning they want more profits, not less. And they're greedy, meaning they want bigger profits, not smaller profits. Meaning you're economically rational. So our starting point is people are economically rational. So it's the only machine we know of that transforms selfish, greedy individuals and individual instincts into this wonderful public good, which is a price that orchestrates supply and demand in the economy. It's a price that's tradable. So if you disagree, you can trade against it. And that's a pretty satisfying place to be. So yes, it's in finance, but I'm pretty happy to be at the Exchange. I'm really happy to be at the Exchange in Singapore.
And do you advise your children on following your footsteps, or are you going to push them more towards machine learning?
I'm going to spread my bets.
Excellent. Michael, that's all the time we have, but it's, as always, a fascinating discussion with you. I enjoy speaking with you today, and best of luck at SGX.
Scott, a lot of super interesting topics covered there, but you talked towards the end about the outlook for carbon trading. As you noted, this market has a lot of potential, but there have been concerns about transparency, the quality of credits, integrity, greenwashing, etc., which creates potential reputational risk for users and could potentially hold this market back. How confident are you about the future of this market?
Well, that's a $64,000 question. We know the voluntary carbon markets can play an important role in helping companies achieve their net zero goals, and it's almost essential. Not every company is going to be able to eliminate 100% of their emissions immediately, and we need some offsets. And in financing those will be a terrific tool, not only to find sources to reduce carbon, but also invest in new and innovative technology. However, if concerns about greenwashing persist, there's little doubt it will hamper growth. And Michael said that people are paying for premium credits, meaning high quality, well understood, reliable credits. On the positive side, regulators like the CFTC are taking a closer look at this market, and they have said that they will clamp down on bad actors, which is exactly what they should be doing. We also have core carbon principles from the Integrity Council for Voluntary Carbon Markets. We'll set the benchmark for quality carbon credits, and we've recently updated our 2022 ISDA verified carbon credit transaction definitions to include the CCP, or the core carbon principles approved label. So all of these important steps will be integrated into those definitions. Given this, I would say that I'm hopeful about the market, and as I think Michael is as well. It's certainly difficult to see how countries and companies can meet their climate goals without them. And the UN will continue to work on its development of rules around these, and I think those will be very important to a successful market.
Yeah, we'll keep our fingers crossed, and we'll obviously keep watching this topic pretty closely as well. Now, voluntary carbon markets will be discussed at the forthcoming ISDA annual general meeting in Tokyo on April 16th to 18th, along with a whole host of other topics, including geopolitical risk, artificial intelligence, which was also discussed on this podcast, non-bank financial intermediation, and treasury clearing. We've got a great lineup of speakers, and we hope you can join us too. You can find out more information and register at agm.isda.org. That's it for this episode. Thanks for listening to The Swap. Keep in touch with ISDA via our website, www.isda.org, and our social media channels. See you next time.